This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Do you keep a journal, or do you wish you kept a journal? Well, help is on the way.
It's the most amazing resource and tool, but most people are not taught how to journal effectively. It's like one of those things you're never taught anywhere.
That's Alice Thomas. We talk with her about her guide to journaling, The Journal Writer's Companion. Then we check in with Thomas's brother, Gareth St. John Thomas, about his terrific guide to learning and writing about a family member's history. It's called Finding True Connections.
It's a project that many, many people start, but almost nobody finishes. And they find it too hard and too complicated, and then it gets political. So we thought what we really need is a process that they can follow. And that has several benefits, because the process in Finding True Connections has been worked out with input from psychologists and input from historians.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Like us on Facebook, Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. I don't know about you, but I'm an inveterate journal starter. I have lots of nice notebooks scattered around the house with various entries from many years going back, but until I read Alice Thomas's book, none of them has been consistently kept. But maybe it's not all my fault. True, I lack both time and, truth to be told, some discipline. But all it really needed was a nudge and a few guidelines from the Journal Writer's Companion, and my journal writing was underway more or less daily. As Thomas points out in the book, many studies show that effective journal writing can help you accomplish your goals. It can also develop emotional intelligence and counteract depression, something Thomas has used in her career as a psychotherapist. In addition to giving you guidelines to writing journals, the Journal Writer's Companion is also a comprehensive reference to all of the different kinds of journaling techniques, from gratitude journals to bullet journals, from legacy journals to art journals. Alice Thomas is a writer and therapist and has worked as a writing coach for over 20 years. In addition to the Journal Writer's Companion, she's also the author of The 1,000 Most Important Questions You Will Ever Ask Yourself. Well, Alice Thomas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Your book, The Journal Writer's Companion, how did you come about to write this book? What inspired you?
Well, like many people, I've written journals pretty much all my life. I remember writing one when I was 4 years old, and ever since. And I kept many of them for years, but didn't know what to do with them. And then I was in a situation where I had to teach students how to do useful, productive journal writing for their courses, for their training, for the reflective learning journal, and also to help them in their writing projects. And I realized there just wasn't anything around that would really help them. So I had to write it myself. And the other thing I found is that going over my old journals, I found they were really not much help to me because they were just written in a kind of stream of consciousness kind of format with no dates and no headings. And it took me ages to go through them and find anything useful in them. And I had to, to dispose of most of them. So I really got thinking, well, what is productive and useful journal writing? And I found over the years I've developed methods that make a huge difference in my own life, that when I do productive journaling, my projects move forward, including this book, in fact. You know, this book came out of a journal writing process. And so why wouldn't anyone want to use that resource? Because it is cheap, what's virtually free, isn't it? And available to anyone. And it is the most amazing resource and tool, but most people are not taught how to journal effectively. It's like one of those things you're never taught anywhere, but you're supposed to magically know, like, for example, mindfulness or study skills, you know, things like this. We're all meant to understand how to do it. But you just need a little bit of basic education and guidance in order to be able to get the most out of a tool like this. So this is where the book came from.
One of the things that one realizes by reading your book, The Journal Writer's Companion, is how many different kinds of ways to journal there are. So let's start off with the general picture. What are the therapeutic benefits of journaling? You are a psychotherapist, is that correct?
Yes, I am. Yes, so I do use it with my psychotherapy clients, but that's a specific type of journaling where I ask them to journal their homework assignments, or I ask them to focus on an issue, one issue at a time that they want to work with, and to define the problem and then define the behavior they want to change and define the resources that they will need or the changes that they will need to make in order to bring about improvements. So it's not about journaling how miserable you feel. I don't recommend that at all. It's about using your journal as a resource to help you stay on focus, to stay on your goal. I think with many people, the most important aspect of learning to journal is to clarify your focus, what it is you want to journal about.
So I wasn't speaking so much specifically, although that was quite interesting, actually. But, you know, more generally, what can journaling do for us in the way of not therapy in the narrow sense, but in a healing way?
The point is that journaling enables you to be present with yourself in a way that you can't really do very easily in any other situation. And if you're present with yourself, with your problems, your issues, your queries, your reflections about your relationship, what you want to do, how you want to progress on a project, any of that, if you give that, you know, careful, present attention in your journal in a structured way, that is going to lift you up. It's going to help you move forward. There are quite a lot of pretty clearly proven benefits to journaling. I'm sure you've heard about the gratitude journaling. I'm sure everyone's heard of that by now, where, because a lot of psychologists have tested this kind of thing, and people that write down celebrations and appreciations of their life and things that they're grateful for feel better because they're focusing their attention on the positive rather than on the negative. So the journal always needs to be a place where you focus on what is constructive and forward moving.
Yes, and you also use a term I would like you to explain, in training your coherence. What does that mean?
So it sounds a bit long-winded, but it's not really. It's about keeping yourself organized and on track so that if, for example, you wanted to increase your income by $10,000 in 2020, for example, you keep focusing on that topic and you bring everything to bear on it that you need to bring. So you would need to think about, well, how am I actually going to do that? You know, am I going to get some more clients or work some more hours at work? And then keeping your focus on that as a goal, going back to it over and over and over to make sure that you are actually having the right thinking and the right behavior to make something happen. Because it's not enough just to dream about it, and it's not enough just to take action. You've got to have all those things lined up together. So it's simple, really, but it's like walking your talk and talking your walk at the same time.
You also talk about emotional intelligence and journaling. What's the connection?
Well, it gives you can use journaling as a space to reflect upon your emotions, because many of us have strong emotions, but we don't necessarily know why or what to do with them. And so any approach to emotional intelligence is partly about identifying what you're feeling, what has triggered it, and how you would like to respond to that. But if you consider that emotions are a form of inner guidance system, they give you very useful information that you can't get any other way. So if you get a strong feeling or any feeling, it's worth reflecting on, why am I feeling this and what can I do with it and what's it telling me about myself? What do I need to do to move forward with this feeling? Just by the action of focusing on it and writing about it is an active thing. It's not just passive. It's not the same as going round and round in your head. It's completely different, because by writing it down, you become more grounded and more spacious with it.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with writing coach and therapist Alice Thomas about her guide, The Journal Writer's Companion. I'm going to ask you a question. The thing that I think about all the time and that has me in utter despair is the destruction of our future, of our planet, of other species that's going on unabated these days. It's so painful. I'm in such despair about it. It's just the kind of thing I probably should be journaling about, but I can't touch it because it just seems that it will be even more painful. How does one deal with tackling some of the most difficult topics, the ones that, you know, just feel like a hot iron that you don't want to touch?
I think the important thing about this kind of issue, I'm totally on board with you with this, you know, is that we need not to go down the toilet with feeling bad about what's happening, because that is not going to help us. Yeah, so it's like, what can I do to cultivate some hope and do something in a small area of life where I'm able to make a contribution? So change is not going to come about through millions of us going onto Facebook and saying, oh, this is terrible, I'm in despair. That in a way is us being helpless and disempowered. And if you like, the powers that be that do not care about the animals and do not care about the deforestation, do not care about the pollution, yeah, it's fine for them if we're helpless and powerless and ineffective and just moaning and complaining. I think real change happens when a person is inspired to illuminated action, and that only comes from a place of self-reflection, self-care. You have to begin by loving and caring for yourself before you're in a fit place to love and care for your environment. Then you can start looking at, what can I do in a local way? And then, do I feel inspired to go further than that? What can I do that expresses my skill set, my genius, my individuality, my creativity, that feels empowering and exciting for me? Yeah, so where can I make my unique contribution? And how can I get over my feelings of feeling despair and disempowerment? Because that's not going to get us anywhere.
Well, thank you for that. That actually, it brought tears to my eyes. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alice Thomas about her book, The Journal Writer's Companion, Achieve Your Goals, Express Your Creativity, Realize Your Potential. So let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts of journaling. First of all, talk a little bit about physical journals versus computer or app-based journals.
Well, I always recommend, if you can, to write by hand in a physical book, because there are benefits to doing this. It seems that when people write by hand, I think partly because the way that the body is involved, it feels as though people become more stable as journalers, because we're not looking at producing vast quantities of text like you have to if you're doing, for example, professional writing or writing a book. Yeah, it's the quality, it's your relationships, your engagement that counts. And for many people, you know, having an attractive book that you can carry with you is more motivating. It makes it a pleasurable physical experience. I don't particularly recommend the use of journaling apps. One, because they very often have a fixed format that you have to fit into their approach. And also, the data never really belongs to you like it does if it's, you know, on a physical book. So I think that you need to create a journaling space that is you and personal, is all about you and not about fitting into any other system. Having said that, if you want to keep an online journal or journal in a word processing document, you can do that. If you prefer typing to writing, there's nothing to stop you doing that. It's really, the most important thing is to do it in a way that inspires and motivates you, that you will be able to sustain and keep up, because what's important is having regular sessions, having long gaps between the sessions.
Your book is very useful for identifying different kinds of journals to keep different kinds of information. That makes some sense to me. You have the scribble journal, you have brain dump journaling, you have bullet journaling. Let's talk about those three.
So scribble journaling is just like it says, it's just allow yourself to free flow and write down whatever comes to mind. And the point of it is to allow yourself that freedom without judgment. It's not about being perfect. It's allowing yourself to make a mess. A journal should never be a place where you get into perfectionism, because it's a process and it's not a product, and it's all about you having a space just to explore freely. The brain dump process is a very useful process, which I do recommend, whereby you take the time to write down literally everything that's on your mind, all your worries, your concerns, the things that you know that you've got to do, things that intrude into your thinking, all the things you're having to remember. Literally write them all down just in the form of a list. It could take a while to get all that down, but once it's written down, it's different, because it's not floating around in your working memory anymore. It's on paper. And that means that you can start to then get a little bit more in control of it. The next phase is to go through your list and then use different colours or symbols to highlight the different types of items that you've written down. You know, for example, family or housework, or, you know, different topic areas of your life. And then you can then organise those into separate lists of things that you want to attend to. Some of the things that are on the original dump list you probably won't need anymore, but then you could migrate forward all the ones that were important to you that you want to keep. And you can keep them in a book and refer back to them as and when you need to, check them off when they're no longer relevant. Bullet journaling is a kind of super organized approach based a little bit on that approach, although bullet journaling is a system in itself, which was developed by Ryder Carroll, and he developed it originally to solve his own problems. Having an attention deficit disorder, he found himself quite disorganized and not able to keep track of complex information. I think he was a web designer or something like that. And so he developed a system that enabled him to keep track of everything. But the idea of bullet journaling is it's not so much reflective journaling, it's journaling to organize yourself. And so what you do is basically keep a system of super organized lists, and you have symbols so you know the status of each item that you've written down. It's too complicated to explain just in a radio interview. Some people love it and other people don't. It depends. If you're somebody who loves to be super organized and you have a lot of data and a lot of different things happening in your life, it can be an absolute lifesaver.
Well, I have the same kinds of challenges that the author, the inventor of bullet journaling does. And I tried to keep a bullet journal, but I found that it just forced me to be too organized, and it was too exhausting. Some people take it to quite extraordinary extremes. They have wonderful illustrations in their books and all different kinds of, I believe they call them collections, you know, which is just different areas that you want to focus on that they design in different ways. And it all got a little bit overwhelming for me.
Yes, I can completely relate to that. And you have to remember that a lot of the beautiful journals that you see online or on YouTube are written by people who are actually making money from doing this. They're not like normal people like you and me who are trying to run a life, yeah? So I think those kind of beautiful journals are just unrealistic. I teach journaling to real life people, and I would say most of them also find bullet journaling is too detailed and it feels too much in control. But you can make forays into it and take, you know, raid some of the good bits. For example, the idea of having an index and to name and date every entry. I think that's such a useful tip from bullet journaling, that every single item that you write in your journal, you give a title and you put that title into a contents page or an index so you can always find it. I really, really recommend that. And other things you can do, like, you know, write inventories of different topics. I mean, it's quite fun to write lists. List making can be a very productive activity, because once you've got a list on a certain topic, you've got it forever and you can go back and, you know, can be quite enjoyable. You know, like for example, you could write a list about, you know, my favorite music this year. You know, what's the music that I really want to hang on to?
And that is very useful, actually. And again, points back to kind of the usefulness of your book, The Journal Writer's Companion, because you do take ideas from so many different ways of doing journalism. So now let's move on, Alice Thomas. Let's move on to the types of journaling that are more, let's say, self-improvement based or spiritually based. Tell us about, what is life writing?
Life writing is more, it's not so much either of those things. So life writing is, it's my term really, it's when you actually write the story of your life. So that'd be like a memoir, or writing your story in certain ways. So for example, you could write your story, but then you could change the ending and turn the ending into something that you want. Or you could write the story of a relationship, or story of your child, or story of your garden. You know, you can, it's a way of like bringing in a narrative approach and looking at your own life over time. So it's about bringing in a dimension of time. So it can be really helpful to write it in the third person, as she or he, because then it helps you get that little bit of objectivity, that little bit of distance, that witness consciousness, which can help you see your story more clearly. Because like when we read a novel, one of the satisfying things about reading a good novel is seeing the development of a character, a person, over time, as they face into the wind of their conflicts and their difficulties, their relationships, the dilemmas that they're in. And a novel is very satisfying. It shows how a person does that. And so this is a way of writing your own version of your life using some of the techniques of fiction.
And would it be ethical to write the story of somebody else's life in the same way?
You can do so, just entirely ethical to write whatever you want if it's just for your own personal use. Publishing material about someone else's life is another matter, but we're not talking about that, are we?
No, we're not. But some people do publish things. You talk about a legacy journal. In fact, I had a friend who built up a nationwide business and started a U.S.-based association of people who do this kind of thing, who help people write legacy journals, write basically their memoirs for their family. Talk about legacy journals and some of the different ways that, that idea can be used.
Well, I think it is something that many of us would like to do, is leave the story of our life for our children, because the things that you know about your family and family members going back, and the, you know, the culture, the experiences, the memories of the folk who went before, a lot of that will be forgotten and not handed down. And if you think about just how much you maybe learned from your grandparents, if they were available to you. But beyond that, we don't really have that much information apart from hearsay. So I think it's really, really helpful to create a document whereby you transmit what you would like to pass on to the next generation. And you know, what you'd like to pass on is entirely up to you. I mean, some people focus on, you know, things like recipes and photographs, but there's other things you can focus on as well, such as what characters people were like, what their aspirations were, yeah, what their life was like, and how it influenced perhaps the generations going down. Because, for example, living through wars and depressions, things like that, have affected people so much. And you don't necessarily realise how much history affects your own individual family life. And so things like that are very, very interesting to read about later on. So, for example, my son is not at all interested at the moment in anything to do with the wider family. He's just too young, and so he's not interested in hearing about it. And so if I was to write it down, he'd have that, you know, in the future. Another way of doing it, which is very enjoyable, is to interview the older family members and to record it. And then you can take some of that and turn it into a document. And it's really worth doing because, you know, so much of that will die with them if you don't.
Yes, those are wonderful ideas. And now looking to the younger generation, how can we encourage children to do journaling?
I don't find they have much difficulty. It seems to be something that they enjoy. There is a section in the book on how to journal with children, to encourage children to journal. What you need to do is, first of all, make sure that it's not the idea of compulsory writing, which they often have to do at school. You have to make clear that it's not the same as any kind of school assignment. And the other thing that you need to do is make sure that you will never judge and criticize what they write in a journal. That's very, very important, because if you do, you will just inhibit them. And so you can create a space for a child or a young person where they can, you know, the sky's the limit. They can explore any ideas about anything. And depending on what age, there are some different age-appropriate writing prompts in the book. Whether you're talking about young children or teenagers and young adults, obviously they're very different, you know, things that would motivate them. Another thing you can do with a child is to have a journal that you share, and when one of you wants to, you know, share something with the other, you write in it and you leave it on their pillow, and then they respond to it and then give it back to you.
That's a wonderful idea, I would think.
Yes.
Because it's so difficult often for children to initiate conversations, and for parents, you know, who fear that their kids will shut down as soon as they ask them anything about their lives, especially if they're, you know, above the age of 12.
There is a way, it's a way of kind of working around the edges of the privacy that young people so desperately want, as long as you absolutely never read their journal unasked, and you never ever judge or comment on the content, because a journal is a place where you work out your unresolved ideas. I'm sure you've all heard of those situations where a mother has read someone's journal and then, you know, kicked up a fuss about it, you know, because the child is talking about something like, I don't know, self-harming or something like that. It's so important that you don't do that, because the child has got to have a space to work things out. So whatever you write in your journal is not the last word. It's just a working out space. It's like a scratch pad of life.
The scratch pad of life. That's a wonderful phrase. The book is The Journal Writer's Companion, Achieve Your Goals, Express Your Creativity, Realize Your Potential. It's just been a delight to talk with you, Alice Thomas, about this book, as it was a delight to read. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for your interest, and I really, really hope that you continue to enjoy your journaling. There is a free Facebook group that anyone can join if they have questions about journaling. It's Journal Writers for Success, and it's a community of people who are, you know, involved in journaling. It's a grassroots community. I think we are, in a way, I wouldn't say saving the world one journal at a time, but it is a way to get people into a place where they feel happier, more aligned with who they really want to be, and more effective and empowered to make a difference in the world. I mean, and it doesn't cost anything.
Well, great. And we'll put links on the website to that Facebook page. Thanks again, Alice Thomas. It was just terrific. Alice Thomas. Find a link to the Facebook group Journal Writers for Success at writersvoice.net. Next up, exploring and writing about your family's history. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Have you ever thought about writing down a family member's history, a grandparent or an older parent, or even your own history, history that you don't want to lose, history to pass on to your children? But if you're asking about others, it can often be awkward to ask about the past. All too often, the family member in question doesn't seem interested in sharing their history. Or so you may think. Maybe they're just being modest. Maybe they don't think their life is worth talking about. Or if you want to write your own history, maybe you don't know what to focus on. That's where Gareth St. John Thomas's book, Finding True Connections, comes in. It provides a framework and useful prompts to get the conversation started, even if it's just with yourself, and suggestions about how to handle difficult or sensitive topics. Designed as a series of double-page spreads, on the left-hand page is a prompt question, while opposite are notes on how to gain the most meaningful answers, to do yourself or to discover more about a family member. Gareth St. John Thomas is the founder of Exile Publishing. Well, Gareth St. John Thomas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's really lovely to be here, Francesca. Thank you for inviting me.
So this book, Finding True Connections, How to Learn and Write About a Family Member's History, it's really a lovely guide, I think, for people and quite complete. What brought you to decide to do this book?
Well, it's very interesting. We were discovering that from the manuscripts that get sent to us as a publishing house, we got a lot of family histories that were incomplete. And people were asking us to see if we could help. And then we started talking to people who were doing this and realized it's a project that many, many people start, but almost nobody finishes. They find it too hard and too complicated, and then it gets political. So we thought what we really need is a process that they can follow. And that has several benefits, because the process in Finding True Connections has been worked out with input from psychologists and input from historians. And if you're talking to somebody and you're following a process, it's slightly less personal, and therefore it's not a cheeky great niece talking to a great uncle. It's actually somebody trying to work through a process. And we know that if you do this, you will actually get the job done. And many people set themselves out to write something huge and enormous and complicated, and they end up not completing anything. This book allows you to follow a method that we know the job will be done, and we really encourage people to do it. It may not be 100% perfect, but there's absolutely no point in setting out to do something that's enormous and it not happening. And this does allow people to do it. And the other reason we did it, we actually think it's important because there's a whole generation about to disappear that has seen more change in their life than many generations before them, or indeed, I think, the younger generations now. So we think it is important to capture senior members of families' histories. That's another reason we did it. So one of the things about finding true connections is that people can get started. They can actually get started. They can do it in up to 3 interview sessions, no more than 4 hours each. And what we've provided, as well as a standard question, we've provided backup questions. If people get very interested in a subject, here's a little bit more you can ask around it. Not everybody's going to respond to every question, and that's fine. We expect people to skip a couple as they go through the process. But the idea is that it's supposed to be supportive and helpful. It's quite a job doing somebody's history, but if you follow this book, you can end up with 10,000 words, and you can actually do that within a couple of months, and then at least you'll have something. And what we do find out, though, is that people discover extraordinary things they didn't know about their very own relatives. There was one example of somebody had no idea that her father was actually an architect for the first stage of his career. He had no idea at all. Sometimes what is in front of you is often missing. So as part of the process, you can discover all sorts of interesting things about family members that you didn't actually know.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you know, just for a little background, talk about your publishing house,
Exile Publishing. Yeah, it's an independent nonfiction publishing house that is distributed in the USA through Corto, and books are available through all good bookstores and, of course, the major online retailers, including Amazon. We have a division called Emotional Inheritance, and that's to do with all issues affecting those of us who are over 65. We're discovering that people of that age and beyond are very interested in what other people of that age have experienced. And capturing the stories is part of that process. We discovered with a book we did in our New Zealand operation, it was called Keepers of History, and it was interviews with people who were over 100 years old, and what were their stories and what were their secrets, and did they have any magical tips for living a long, happy life. And one of the things that was very interesting is that the book did very well, and we discovered that many people in their 80s and older were buying it, and I asked a couple of them, why did you buy this? And they said, well, nobody actually tells us what life is going to be like in 20 years. Time. And I thought that was quite interesting. And there's a whole theme, if you like, of all us baby boomers getting older, leaving great memories behind which need to be captured, and also wanting to learn from each other too. And that's what Exile Publishing does in its Emotional Inheritance imprint. We publish in, we have an office in Australia, and we have an office in New Zealand, and we are very active in the USA market, where we get quite a lot of our volume now.
Now, did you come to this from your own experience of writing a family member's history?
Yes, a little bit. I came from it more from missing out on somebody. I don't know if my sister mentioned our grandfather. You interviewed my sister, Alice Thomas, the other day. Mentioned our grandfather, Gilbert Thomas, who was, when I was 13, he was a funny little boring man that sat in the back of a room and smoked. And when I was 14, I was coming out of my shell and realized that this was a very interesting man. He was actually an accomplished poet. He was a book reviewer and actually a man of principle. He had spent the First World War in jail as a conscientious objector. And he did all sorts of extraordinary things, but I was too wrapped up in myself to know it until I was just coming out of myself and he passed away. And therefore, finding out his true story was important for me because, again, lots of our ideas and principles that may consciously or subconsciously influence your life are often resident within your relatives. So he was a star for that.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Gareth St. John Thomas about his book, Finding True Connections, How to Learn and Write About a Family Member's History. That's exactly what so many of the questions in your book encourage, the expression thereof. So let's talk about some of the important things that people want to make sure that they cover when they're talking with a family member. And I love the list you have starting on page 2, and I'm going to bring that up for myself, actually. So you say at the end of this process, in addition to a clear outline of a person's life, which of course is important, the biographical details, you should have a sense of the highlights of their life, their accomplishments, challenges and difficulties, also the period in which they live. So you talk about the context. Let's start there. Talk about some of those things I just mentioned, and then we can go on to some of the others.
One of the things that's interesting is that everybody's history is obviously set in their own time period, and thinking people had the same opportunities and ways of doing things as we do now is different. A small example is one of the questions we ask is, where did you get married? And generally around the world, you could only get married in a church until the 1950s. Not everywhere in the world, but generally. And then the time of that wedding actually will determine a little bit about how much was spent on it, and that may tell you something about their social status. But as well as the nuts and bolts of people's lives and the context in which it was in, this process also gets out what they actually believed in, what their values actually were. And those are, I think, the true inheritance that often values and beliefs get passed on generation to generation. And therefore, some of the questions will reveal what's important to people. One of my favourite questions, and an early one, is, you know, what ethnicity do you belong to? And some people go on forever about, you know, their particular community or their particular nation that they came from originally. Mediterranean people in particular tend to do that. Others don't mind at all. They might just simply say, I'm an American, and they'll move on from that. Either way, it's revealing as to how they identify themselves. When they have memories of school, some are very much involved with a whole melting pot of new people and cultures, and it's an exciting time for them. Other people are more excited about work. But most people, interestingly, Francesca, don't want to talk a lot about their work. They've kind of done that. Most people aren't totally in love with the jobs that they did. They did them. They're okay with them. But it wasn't something that they thought was very much of them, and they're far more interested in talking about their family and their childhood than their working years, which I find interesting.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, I actually think most people enjoy their jobs, but aren't living because of it. I think the family and the memories of family are far more important to them as you get older. And I think the older you are, the less important your working years were. They were just a phase that you had to go through. Don't get me wrong, some people do talk about work quite happily, but early childhood memories are often more important to older people than their more recent working memories. Maybe because their jobs weren't that interesting. I don't know.
And of course, going back to something earlier that you said, when you say church, you probably mean people being married in a religious setting.
Yes, that's right. Yes, indeed. As I say, around the world, it's only recently that you don't have to do that. And now that it is a person that marries you, actually is a person with the sanctification, if you like, not the place.
So some of the other things that you talk about are, you know, things like their favorite sayings, their idioms. Why is that important?
Well, I think often people have particular phrases and turns of phrase that defines them almost as the sound of their voice can define people. So there's a lovely phrase somebody captured on an interview, and he always, when asked how he was, he always says, "I've never seen a brighter day." Which is a lovely way of telling you a lot about him. He's a positive, happy character. And it's good, I think, to have captured that, because it would be terrible if that died when he did. And it is often a kind of handle and a metaphor for people's lives, the particular phrases that they use. And everybody has their own unique phrases and ways of asking questions and the ways of looking at life. And recording that, I think, is valuable. To lose, for example, the idea of "I've never seen a brighter day" would be such a shame. So I'm glad they've caught that.
Well, that's lovely, because you're really asking the questioner to pay close attention to the details of expression, not just the facts.
Yeah, absolutely, because that gets to the essence of the person. I mean, the facts are almost indisputable, and sometimes you will find that people have different memories, and that's okay. The facts are almost indisputable, but the essence of a person is what we hope you can drag out. Incidentally, one of the things we've discovered, Francesca, in when people do this process, is immensely useful for the person being interviewed. Typically, she or he will say, well, I haven't done very much. But when you actually probe, you discover they may have lived through the impact of at least two wars, the spread of personal computing, the introduction of the hospice movement, the availability of relatively cheap travel, and seen life completely change. And that helps put it in context for them. The other thing that is useful for people being interviewed is, well, I don't know about you, I'm not quite sure I could put in order the things I did in the last 2 weeks. So if you have a whole long life behind you, things get muddled and the chronology gets muddled and you can turn around and look at it. It's all a bit of a fog. And this process clarifies that for the interviewee, and they can actually see how things fitted into what order. And the other thing we find is that people, certainly 75 plus, don't often get listened to as much as perhaps they should. And this gives them a voice, and they enjoy talking about things, and they discover more about themselves when they're doing it too. So as well as an interesting process for the person doing the interviewing and their families, the interviewee gets a real positive benefit from this. We always see that they get quite more cheerful and more positive about themselves and think, yes, I really have had an interesting life so far. I have done all these things, which I've forgotten about. And sometimes the memories that are invoked are pleasant and happy and cheerful ones, and sometimes they're not, but it's also all affirms the depth and range of the individual's life, and that's a good thing to experience.
Yeah, and you know, at the end, toward the end of this book, you also list a section for the future. Why, first of all, what do you ask people about the future, and why did you put that in?
Well, I think what people in the 70s and 80s may have is more of an insight as to what is likely to happen, because they've got just simply more experience, and therefore they may be able to project more. And how they think things will be in the future is at least interesting. It may just be of an almost academic interest, but they may predict things. We get all sorts of interesting answers from that. Surprisingly, recently I've heard that people are saying, well, we think people are going to go back a little bit away from their devices. They're going to start talking to each other a bit more. I think that may be wishful thinking, I don't know. And also, some people are very optimistic that actually some of the environmental issues we're dealing with will be faced with, will be dealt with. Because in a way, we're talking to what could loosely be called the greatest generation, the generation that built things, changed things, made things, and built America in a way. And the level of confidence and optimism in the future is sometimes brighter in the older generations than it is in the younger ones. Either way, the answers are always interesting.
Well, that is interesting because, you know, I'm a boomer and my mother was part of the greatest generation. I think she was much more optimistic about the future than I am. So there probably is a kind of, you know, there we're talking about historical context in which you grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. And because that generation, your mother's generation, saw an incredible amount of change. If you can surmount the Second World War, get through the Depression and move on, you're probably going to believe there's not a lot that can't be dealt with, which is one of the things that makes America great. So it's worth listening to that generation, I think.
I hope they're right.
Yes, so do I. But, you know, they do have the advantage of experience. And looking through the challenges that perhaps our generation, I'm a boomer too, that perhaps our generation has gone through, though they feel quite extreme, they're not as extreme. Yes, we had the edges of the Vietnam War and we've had the Middle East wars, but they haven't really involved things like rationing, which many people had, or state control of everything, which many people had, or the horrors of the 1930s depression. We've never seen anything since. So I think it's worth believing in the optimism of the older generation. They have a right to believe that. Their experience suggests things get dealt with.
So you also talk about leaving advice. And, you know, advice can be something that's interesting, but you know, there can be different ways of trying to elicit it. I can imagine saying, well, what advice do you have for the younger generation, and really not get too much. So how do you tease that out?
Well, it's interesting because one of the points of the book, Finding True Connections, is to get people's stories and to get people's beliefs. But one of the things it doesn't want to do is leave time bombs. And we have had answers like, well, yeah, watch out for that Angela. She's not up to much good. We kind of don't really want that in the book. We can remove that. And generally, it comes down to very simple answers. And the one that is standard, that's almost a default answer that people seem to have, is actually tell people to enjoy themselves a bit more and stop taking themselves so seriously. Life is good and to be enjoyed, and make use of every single day and stop worrying. It's really the main common message that comes through. Other people have much more detail. They say make sure that you water the garden this way and you change these seeds over every so often. It depends a little bit on their interest, obviously, Francesca. But as I say, the main message or the main advice that this generation seems to want to leave isn't much more complicated than living a bit more now and enjoying yourselves a bit more and stop worrying about work and stop worrying so much about money. Just get on with things and have fun. It sounds remarkably simple, but it's quite hard to achieve.
In other words, be more in the moment.
Very much so, yeah. And enjoy where you are. I think one of the ironies of having so many more entertainment resources, if you like, or more resources altogether, you are a lot less in the moment than that generation actually was, because they had less distractions. And they also talked to each other more as well.
Yes, I agree with that. I'm so glad that I lived most of my life in the analog world, not in the digital.
Yes, I understand. Absolutely understand that.
So what are some of the biggest challenges for people in finding out about a family member's history?
They've got to make sure that the process is done in a formal basis. The way it can often work is, you know, hey, great uncle so-and-so, we really think your story is terrific. I'd like to record it, please. And he'll normally mutter something. And then once you've actually agreed that he or she will do it, you then actually have to agree a time or a series of times. You have to work out who else is going to be present as well. Very often an overbearing husband or an overbearing wife or partner of one form or another can sometimes get in the way. But also if they're very old, they may need to have a carer around. You really need to be thoughtful, if you like, about the hygiene factors as to how is this going to be done. What we suggest you do is that you have a card, and we produce these cards as well. Each question has a card. You put the card with the question in front of the person being interviewed, and that slightly depersonalizes it, because she or he will be looking at the card. And when you, the interviewer, have decided that you've got all the answers you want, and you want to move it on, you just simply put the next card down on the pack. Alternatively, you can just show them the questions that are printed up in a very large scale inside the book, Finding True Connections. But getting those organisational factors, I think, are very important. And don't forget, people will get tired as well. The other thing that we strongly suggest that you do ahead of time is actually get the nuts and bolts correct of the names and the genealogy as to who was related to who and who was married when, and get those names and dates sorted out, because that can take quite a lot of time and can actually befuddle people before they start thinking about what really, really matters. So one of the challenges is to get organised, agree times, make sure that they're comfortable, that there aren't too many people interfering that they don't want to be. And the other thing you've really got to be incredibly sure about is that this is not your story. It's not about you. If you're doing the interviewing and you're finding yourself using the word I, get out of it. It's not about you. You've got to get their story. And then the other challenging bit is that although it may seem less than perfect, you have to write it up quickly. Even though you would have recorded it on an iPhone or another device, even though you would have recorded it and made good notes, sometimes the essence and the emphasis will disappear fairly quickly. So you really have to do this. We think we should really get the whole project from start to end done within just 10 weeks. And it makes it a manageable project for a summer period, for example, or you could start it around Christmas time when people are around, and you know, they could have it by the end of February. And the other thing is, don't try for perfection. You won't get there. You'll do something very good and very useful. But if you're seeking to get something that's absolutely perfect, you won't do anything. It'll be such a shame. The other thing is to actually enjoy the process too, because these people do have quite a lot to say, and no one's asked them for a long time very often as to what they believe in and what really happened. And I'd be surprised if anybody who follows a process in finding true connections doesn't discover quite a lot of things they'd never imagined before.
Well, that is all sounds so interesting, and what a wonderful process and a way to bring the generations together. Gareth St. John Thomas, your book is Finding True Connections, How to Learn and Write About a Family Member's History. Thank you so much for talking with us here at Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we love your show. Thank you so much, Francesca.
Gareth St. John Thomas. Finding True Connections is out from his own company, Exile Publishing. And here's a poem by the great Native American writer and poet, Sherman Alexie. It's about stories and is called The Summer of Black Widows. The spiders appeared suddenly after that summer rainstorm. Some people still insist the spiders fell with the rain, while others believe the spiders grew from the damp soil like weeds with 8 thin roots. The elders knew the spiders carried stories in their stomachs. We tucked our pants into our boots when we walked through fields of fallow stories. An Indian girl opened the closet door, and a story fell into her hair. We lived in the shadow of a story trapped in the ceiling lamp, the husk of a story museumed on the windowsill. Before sleep, we shook our blankets, and stories fell to the floor. A story floated in a glass of water left on the kitchen table. We opened doors slowly and listened for stories. The stories rose on hind legs and offered their red bellies to the most beautiful Indians. Stories in our cereal boxes, stories in our firewood, stories in the pocket of our coats. We captured stories and offered them to the ants who carried the stories back to their queen. A dozen stories per acre. We poisoned the stories and gathered their remains with broom and pan. The spiders disappeared suddenly after that summer lightning storm. Some people insist the spiders were burned to ash, while others believe the spiders climbed the lightning bolts and became a new constellation. The elders knew the spiders had left behind bundles of stories. Up in the corners of our old houses, we still find those small white bundles, and nothing, neither fire nor water, neither rock nor wind, can bring them down. That was the poem The Summer of Black Widows by Sherman Alexie. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Michael Clare about his latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.